Welcome to this W Audio presentation of C.S. Lewis's The Four Loves, with introduction and commentary by Charles Colson.
Hi, I'm Chuck Colson. Welcome to what I hope will be a rare and memorable experience for all who listen. This unique audio series entitled The Four Loves is rich in wisdom and wit, reflecting the unmistakable candor and style of its author, C.S. Lewis. As one of the foremost writers and thinkers of the 20th century, Clive Staples Lewis is remarkable for many reasons. It's been said that during his lifetime, he fulfilled three very distinct professions, all quite successfully. He was the Oxford and Cambridge scholar and teacher whose works on English literature remain standard classics today. He was the novelist and children's writer who created new worlds to test old truths. And he was the Christian apologist and theologian who dared to ask and then answer the tough questions about his faith. It's in this last realm of professions that I first encountered the influence of C.S. Lewis. In August of 1973, I'd been an ambitious attorney. I'd worked as special counsel for President Nixon in the White House. That tumultuous year, that summer of 1973, the head of a large electronics firm handed me a book, small, lightweight, less than 200 pages, the title, Mere Christianity. I read it, and I thought about it, and prayed over it, and ultimately underwent a dramatic conversion to Christ. I will always be grateful for the uncommon clarity and accessible doctrine presented in that C.S. Lewis classic. Another classic entitled The Four Loves showcases that same kind of clear-thinking brilliance. Originally published in 1960, this Anatomy of Love was written during the period of Lewis's late-in-life marriage to American Joy Davidman. With authority, warmth, and humor, he reflects on the four basic kinds of human love: affection, friendship, eros, and charity. He explores the promise and peril of these loves, showing how each is able to merge into one another. Lewis argues that along with the rewards of love, there are risks, but he recommends taking them, saying the only place outside heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers and perturbations of love is hell. He concludes it's the divine likeness in all our human loves that's reflective of their heavenly element. Only what's heaven-like can enter heaven. All else, when shaken, will fall. Therefore, any love that's allowed to be a proper love for someone or something has a heavenly element and is in fact also a love for God. What you're about to hear is literally one of a kind. It's the only professional recording of C.S. Lewis's voice in existence today. In 1958, just 5 years before Lewis's death and 2 years before The Four Loves was released in print, he recorded the essence of his future book, reading directly from his original handwritten manuscript. Although recorded in London, these talks in the rich and vibrant voice fondly remembered by thousands of Oxford and Cambridge students reached a nationwide audience in the United States. It was the only time Lewis was presented on radio in America. Dr. Chad Walsh, a Lewis friend and biographer, commented on this series, saying, in a real sense, C.S. Lewis lives again, wise and witty, loving and penetrating, an experienced guide into the human and divine mysteries of love. What better bequest could a man leave the world? Here in the living voice is word of that ultimate love that moves the sun and the other stars, the love that sang the universe into existence. Whether you're just discovering Lewis or have been a longtime reader, we're pleased to offer you the Four Loves teaching series. It comes with a heartfelt prayer that all who participate will be led to a deeper understanding of our love for each other and of God's love for us. As we prepare to begin session one, I'd like to share a bit of C.S. Lewis trivia. It's documented that Lewis's dear friend, J.R.R. Tolkien, author of Lord of the Rings, once chided him for writing so many theological books. "I wish I didn't have to," replied Lewis, "but until the ordained clergy begin to communicate with ordinary people in the vernacular in a way they can understand, then I'm going to have to do it." Well, as you will hear, Lewis's talent for communicating truth to the masses shines brightly through this series. Listen for his in-depth yet common-sense explanations, for his helpful images, and for his personal experiences. Because love is an often misunderstood and overused word, Lewis has established this discourse on the Greek language. Unlike English, it's much more precise in its use of words. The first session begins with the most humble and widespread of the four loves. In the Greek, it's called storge, and is defined as affection, especially of parents to children. It's believed that whatever tangible and consistent happiness we find in our lives can be explained by affection. It seeps through the whole texture of our lives, and according to Lewis, it's the base for the other loves. But it's not all positive and polite in this study of affection. Lewis is not shy in reviewing the questions of jealousy, possessiveness, and plain old bad manners in the arena of love. These perversions of affection, as Lewis describes them, sneak in when we least expect them, but they deserve our corrective attention. It's noteworthy that C.S. Lewis constantly explores the virtues and dangers of affection in his fiction. For example, in his story, The Great Divorce, the ghost of a mother desires to possess her son even after death. And in the novel, Till We Have Faces, the deep affection that one character feels for her sister turns into a destructive jealousy that cannot be distinguished from love. And now as you begin to listen to these recordings, read the scriptures, study the workbook, and participate in the discussions. My prayer is that you'll be both challenged and encouraged. And remember the words of Jesus found in the book of Matthew. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment, and second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. God bless you as you embark on this exciting exploration of the nature of love.
In Greek, they have four words for love. Storge, S-T-O-R-G-E, means affection, the sort of love that ought to be between near relations. Philia, P-H-I-L-I-A, means friendship. Eros, E-R-O-S, is of course the love between the sexes. And agape, A-G-A-P-E, is love in the Christian sense, God's love for man and the Christian's love for the brethren. I want to talk about all four, and I'll begin with storge, or affection. Almost anyone, it seems, can be loved with storge. The ugly, the stupid, even the exasperating can be its objects. There need be no apparent fitness between those whom it unites. It ignores even the barriers between species. We see it not only between dog and man, but, more surprisingly, between dog and cat. What's common to all the objects of storge is that they are familiar. We can often identify the very day and hour when a friendship began or when we fell in love. But we never catch storge at the moment of its beginning. To become aware of it is to become aware that it's already been going on for some time. In our storge, we're rather like the dogs, who wag their tails at familiar people even if they've never done them any kindness, and bark at strangers even if they've never done them any harm. This apparently indiscriminate character in storge and its dependence on familiarity point to its animal and biological origins. Let me say at once, for this will often come across us in the following talks, that I don't mean the word animal to be derogatory. Nothing in man is either better or worse for being shared with the beasts. The distinction between what we share and what is specifically human is not a moral one. When we blame a man for behaving like a beast, we mean that he displays characteristics common to man and beast on occasions where those peculiar to man were demanded. What we call brutality in man, say in a Russian or German torturer, is usually behavior which the brutes in fact don't exhibit. My Greek lexicon defines storge as affection, especially of parents to offspring. And that, I've no doubt, is the original form of the thing, as well as the central meaning of the word. We understand the later, more remote ramifications of it if we start with the right basic image. A mother nursing a baby, a bitch or a cat with a basket full of puppies or kittens, all in a squealing, nuzzling heap together, continuously moving yet somehow at rest, a warm animal smell and all the noises. But while the original form of storge is thus seen in the nursery or the basket, it branches out in all directions. But however far storge travels from its source, it still retains from it a strong flavour. It's usually the humblest of the loves. It gives itself no airs. Storge is modest, even furtive and shamefaced. Storge has a very homely face, so of many of those for whom we feel it. It's no proof of your cleverness or perceptiveness or refinement that you love them, nor that they love you. To have to produce storge in public is like getting your household furniture out for a move. It was all right in its native place, but it looks tawdry out of doors. And the feeling of Storgy is so nearly organic, so gradual, so unemphatic, that you can no more pride yourself on it than on getting sleepy towards bedtime. It lives with humble, undressed, private things. The thump of a drowsy dog's tail on the kitchen floor, the sound of a sewing machine, easy laughter and easy tears on some shrewd and wrinkled old face, a toy left on the lawn. It's the most comfortable and least ecstatic of loves. It is to our emotions what soft slippers and an easy, almost worn-out chair and old clothes are to our bodies. Wraps you round like a blanket, almost like sleep. At its best, gives you the pleasures, the ease and relaxation of solitude, without solitude itself. If we were talking about drinks, our section on gin would certainly have to note the fact that besides being a drink in its own right, gin is an excellent base or medium for several mixed drinks. Storgy is similarly a base or medium for other loves. Being the oldest, most spontaneous form in which we go out of ourselves towards others, it is naturally taken up both into friendship and into eros. One might say it clothes them. In the end, all those things about your friends, which had nothing to do with the friendship originally, become dear because they become familiar. As for eros, I can think of few things more distressing than to experience it for more than a very short time without Storgy. Every good marriage, even every courtship, makes for its eros, so to speak, a nest of Storgy, like the nest of rice you build for your helping of curry. This relation between eros and Storgy is well seen in the two outward expressions they have in common. One is the kiss. Which borrowed this from the other, I don't know. It's not enough to say that you kiss your child and you kiss the woman you love, but in very different ways. For kisses between lovers aren't always lovers' kisses. The truth is that Storgy kisses in one way only, while Eros kisses both in Storgy's way and in his own, expressing sometimes the most transporting passion, sometimes quiet affection, and often many intermediate states in between. The second expression in common is more embarrassing. Lovers as well as parents tend to indulge in baby language. This makes many modern people, me among them, uncomfortable. I've spoken of Storgy so far mainly in terms of comfort and heart's ease, something that oils the wheels of life. But it has far higher values. It comes near to Agape's power of loving the unlovable. It certainly loves the unattractive. It doesn't do this quite in Agape's way. A mother, say, loves an intrinsically unlovable son because nature compels her, because in caring for him she fulfills a need of her own. Storgy, without being Agape, imitates her actions. Then secondly, as we've seen, it's familiarity that qualifies people to be the object of Storgy. And of course it's the circumstances of our lives, many of them accidental, grown up we hardly know how, that have made them familiar. We haven't chosen them. They can include men whom we should never have selected as friends and women with whom we could never conceivably have fallen in love. Familiarity teaches us first to endure and then to enjoy humanity in forms most alien to us, as habit teaches us to like foods we didn't naturally like. Lovers and friends feel, it's not always a delusion, that they were made for one another. The glory of Storgy is that it unites those who most emphatically, even comically, are not. The acquaintances we make for ourselves are, of course, chosen to suit our own tastes, people of our sort. The possible objects of Storgy are just whoever happens to live under the same roof or meet you every day. You need a really Catholic taste to be able to get something out of any odd collection of books found in a hotel. You may need only a very narrow one to enjoy all the books in your own study. You chose them. When we thus come to love the unattractive, what was unattractive to us, we're often led on to a momentous and sobering discovery. We find in them, it may be, great humour, sense, or even goodness. Not goodness of some particular kind that happens to please our own palate, just goodness. We shouldn't have noticed it if mere familiarity hadn't bred affection. It wouldn't have attracted us. We now see that it ought to have. We learn how very narrow our range of appreciations is, how little taste for goodness we have, except when it's dressed and served to suit our idiosyncrasy. But mellowed by Storge, we almost reach the stage of loving goodness itself. Now at this point we must be on our guard. For really, from everything that's been said, the resemblance between Agape and Storge is astonishing. Storge is not puffed up. It suffers long and is kind. It loves the unlovable, yet also loves goodness, which is the essentially lovable. We might be tempted to identify the two. To say that what I've been calling Storge is not a special and wholly natural kind of love, but love itself, or goodness, the rightful sovereign of the world. Such identification seems implicit in much 19th century fiction, in Trollope and Thackeray, even at times in George Eliot. The conflict between good and evil is represented simply as a conflict between the domestic affections and, say, ambition or snobbery or gambling or whatnot. And when the hero is claimed or reclaimed by the domestic affections, we're apparently meant to feel that he's saved. Of course, no Christian could accept this idolatry of the domestic affections. Those authors write as if they'd never heard, never even felt the need of denying the text about hating wife and mother and one's own life also for Christ's sake. We've been better taught. We know that every natural impulse, however innocent in itself, may stand between God and us and so become an idol. But that's not the side of the thing I want to emphasize at the moment. These authors also take insufficient notice of some facts about Storge which are discernible without Christian instruction. They're a matter of common observation and bitter experience. I leave out of account for the moment its dangers as a possible rival to God. How often, how long, if left to her merely natural workings, does Storge succeed in realizing even the natural and this worldly good which she seems to promise? Storge, unless she submits to something higher than herself, does not remain Storge. This natural love carries in itself the seeds of natural hatreds. Every one of its characteristics is ambivalent. Almost anyone, I've said, may be loved by Storge. Yes, and most of us expect to be. The egregious Mr. Pontifex, in Samuel Butler's Way of All Flesh, is shocked that his son doesn't love him. It's unnatural that a boy should not love his own father. He assumes that Storge is a sort of love laid on or built in by nature. It's ready-made. It's on the house. We need to do nothing to deserve it. Storge is often assumed as a right, and often the party who has done nothing lovable hungers to be loved and continues to be not only disappointed but shocked and outraged because he's not. And once this situation exists, it will continually worsen. If someone's already unlovable, a continual demand on his part to be loved as of right, his sense of injury, create in us a sense of guilt, guilt for a fault we couldn't have avoided and can't by any effort of will cease to commit. For if in some favoured moment any germ of affection stirs in us, his demand for more and still more freezes us up again, and each becomes a torment to the other. I once knew a mother who incessantly complained of her adolescent daughter's lack of affection. What more could I do for her than I do, she asked. I live for her. And the pitiful fact is that this was, in a sense, true. She was no frivolous, neglectful, or self-indulgent mother. She worked hard for the girl, denied herself lots for her, was always making things for her, giving her presents, arranging treats. But it never occurred to her to consider whether all these things and presents and treats were those the girl wanted. Though often complaining that the daughter didn't confide in her, she never in any serious degree listened to anything the daughter said. The dawning interests of adolescence were swept aside with jokes. Needless to add, any effort made by the daughter to put her own point of view on a disputed matter was a total failure. If she put it at all trenchantly, she met reproaches and finally temper. If she put it gently, she was met by sobs and embraces and cuddlings and pet names. For the mother held the common belief that scenes, as they are very justly called, of affection, solve all problems and remove all tensions. In reality, of course, they usually leave things just where they were, unless, indeed, the debauch of emotion, like other debauches, leaves a hangover. Now, no small part of this mother's unlovableness consisted in downright bad manners. We're always hearing complaints about the rudeness of the rising generation. But though I'm nearly 60 myself, I'm far more often impressed with the rudeness of parents to their children. Who has not been the embarrassed guest at family dinners where one or other of the parents treated their grown-up offspring with an incivility which, practiced on any other young people, would have terminated the acquaintance? Ruthless interruption, flat contradiction, loud ridicule of things the children take seriously or even hold sacred, insulting references to their best friends, dogmatic assertions in matters about which the young are instructed and their elders ignorant, provide a ready answer to the old question, why are they always out? Why do they seem to prefer every house in the neighbourhood to their own? They prefer civility to barbarism. This barbarism, which renders not only conversation, but even real acquaintance impossible, grows very easily out of one element in Storgy. I've compared it to old clothes and slippers, an undress affair. But this most delightful and important element can be revoltingly misinterpreted and abused. It is right to wear your old clothes at home, but not to wear the same underclothes till you smell. It's a sort of distinction some people don't seem to make. Because home is, or should be, a place where formality of manners isn't required, they think it's a place where no manners are required. Of course, the mistake is made only by people of a certain inner and essential grossness. Those who leave their good manners behind them when they come home from the party can have had no really good manners even there. But, of course, in such a mother as I'm speaking of, there's a far darker streak. The daughter is to have everything she can give, but, if possible, nothing that anything or anyone else gives. This is important because it's not a departure from Storgy. It's a congenital malady in Storgy. Storgy's born with the tendency to it. It's not a weakness which needs specially adverse conditions to bring it out. It will come out unless measures are taken to guard against it. And you see how it naturally arises from the very origins of Storgy. The whole appeal of the baby or of the young is their total dependence on the mother. And, of course, it's not only mothers who respond to that. We all, in some measure, feel the appeal of the helpless. And if, in supplying their needs, we also gratify an emotional need of our own, there's no harm in that. A duty is none the worse for being also a pleasure. Yes. But, of course, as the creature ceases to be helpless, this particular pleasure will cease. All the activities involved in caring for a child, for instance, are directed to that end. We feed it and wash it and teach it to walk and talk in order that it may presently do all these things without our help. We are, or should be, labouring to make ourselves unnecessary. Does the knowledge, I am no longer necessary, strike like a nail? If so, we must, I believe, conclude that our Storgy was not the sort of love that desires the good of its object. We have desired for it not good as such, but only that amount and kind of good which we could gratify our own need by giving. Those who cannot bear to become unnecessary have various ways of dealing with the situation. The least mischievous is to set up a substitute object such as a spoiled dog. Much less desirable is the attempt to persuade yourself that you still are needed after all. This, of course, is done by inventing imaginary needs in the other parties. You can thus work your fingers to the bone doing things for your family. True, a moment's reflection, or even your family's repeated assertions, would tell you that most of these things were unnecessary, undesired, and a perfect nuisance to everybody. It's no use to tell the corresponding type of woman that she'd much better discontinue her works of supererogation, because if she did, she would be faced with the very fact she's trying to avoid. So long as she keeps on, she can feel necessary, and she has also other gratifications. The laboriousness reassures her about the quality of her love, a subject on which she has repressed doubts. It whispers to her, as long as her back aches and her feet burn, how much I must love them if I do all this. But also, more terribly, the unappreciativeness of the others, the unforgettable wounding words, for any words will wound a person of that sort, in which they point out that the laundry really does the washing very much better and they can afford to send it out, or that they all actually prefer cold lunches, give her what seems just cause for her feeling of ill usage. Therefore, for the sweets of resentment. She is so obviously in the right and they in the wrong. But can resentment be sweet to those who love? It's perhaps a question of terminology. Certainly, ordinary usage allows us to describe as love many states which already contain a very substantial ingredient of hatred. It's, of course, a gross error to suppose that jealousy is specially associated with erotic love. Even in the injured wife or husband, the feeling has often quite as much to do with wounded storge as with the infringement of sexual possession. Every sort of love wants the same eye. Unconverted or uncorrected storge in her merely natural condition is jealous. This jealousy is by no means confined to parents. Two children, brother and sister, grow to a certain age sharing all their interests. Then a dreadful thing happens. An interest which one can't share enters the life of the other. Say literature or serious music or botany. The one who's left behind feels it's a kind of treason. His jealousy of the new interest is usually expressed by ridicule. The thing's all silly nonsense anyway. The other's only pretending to like it, only showing off. This explains in part the seemingly almost fiendish rancor often displayed by a lowbrow family when one member of it shows signs of becoming intellectual, or of an unbelieving or worse still semi-believing family when one member becomes a Christian. I used to think that both these were due to a sort of disinterested hatred, the one for what is intellectually high and the other for God himself, God who is in the long run the supreme object of all human jealousies. But perhaps it's not quite so bad as that. It's the reaction to desertion. One who is all ours has become in part a stranger. And above all, change has begun. The seemingly immemorial order has cracked. This is the beginning of the end, the first breath of winter. For Storge, whose very food is the familiar, dislikes alteration. Sometimes a curious double jealousy is felt. We're jealous of the new interest because it has stolen the heart we love. But it's possible at the very same moment to be jealous the other way round. Supposing for a moment there were, after all, anything in all this classical music or this religion, why in heaven's name should he or she see it when we don't? Why should they be selected for admission to it? Why not we? The mildest and safest line the older generation seized with such jealousy can take is to say, tolerantly, indulgently, it's a phase, it'll all blow over. This is a capital device. For it's very galling to the chit or whippersnapper you're talking at, and at the same time not very easy to resent. It even has the incidental advantage that you may believe it. Better still, it may even turn out to be true. And it won't be our fault if it doesn't. I was talking about storge, or affection, in its depraved form. I don't think we gain much by describing these nasty states of mind as neuroses. If the word means that they are, in a spiritual sense, diseased states, we knew that already. If it means they are literally disease, so that we're no more responsible for them than for measles or some kind of insanity, we all know this to be untrue. Which of us for one single day can live with those he loves best and not feel the impulse to demand much and to give little, to love them rather as extensions of ourselves than as free souls for whom we and all things were made. These temptations, in fact, are on a par with all our others. You might as well call it a neurosis when I stay in bed too long in the morning, or snap back, or take more than my fair share of the strawberries. To be a self is ipso facto to be potentially selfish. If you're going to call all this neurosis, the real name of that neurosis is being a fallen man. The old word sin was often used. Again, neurosis might imply that we needn't repent nor labour to amend, but only have a treatment. Now, of course, it's true that in particular cases there is a real neurosis. There are causes outside the offender's consciousness which make impossible to him what is hard to all, or which at least make it harder for him to resist these temptations and make his behaviour worse when he yields. On that peculiarity, therapeutics may work. But it's working on the peculiar aggravation of something which is both normal and detestable. The peculiarity may perhaps be cured. But the radical, the congenitally human selfishness behind it is not a question of cure in that sense. Medicine labours to preserve or restore natural structure or normal function. But greed and pride aren't unnatural or abnormal in the same sense as astigmatism or a floating kidney. For who in heaven's name could describe as normal or natural in the medical sense the soul from which they were totally absent? Natural in a quite different sense, if you like, arch-natural, seen only once since the fall. And certainly not at all like the psychologist's picture of the integrated, adjusted, balanced, happily married, satisfactorily employed, popular, regular citizen. You can't really be so well adjusted to your world, you know, if it ends by nailing you up to a stake of wood. But long before this, I expect, some listener wants to interrupt me with the protest, I thought you defined storge as a kind of love. All these horrors you've been describing are not love at all, they're unlove. And of course, such a listener's perfectly right. One way of treating my subject would be to say that just as there is none good but God and nothing good but goodness, so there are no loves but love itself, the very love, and that what I call the other and natural loves are not loves at all in their own right, but become so only insofar as they participate in the very love. Well, I welcome everyone who was thinking that before we began, and I shall have failed with everyone who isn't thinking it by the end. And after all, storge, even in its depraved condition, has many of the characteristics of what we call love in ordinary speech. It desires some good for its object. It feels pain when the object is absent, though not always pleasure when it's present, and anxiety when the object is in danger. And by a peculiar paradox, which would be comic if it weren't so very miserable, it may feel lasting sorrow on being bereaved of one with whom the mourner passed hardly a day unmarred by quarrels. For storge is great at laying flowers and graves and keeping anniversaries, sometimes far better at lamenting you when you're dead than being fair to you while you're alive. This is the reason, I think, why one often feels disgust at many of the sentimental songs about storge, like Home Sweet Home. They treat as holy something which is rarely capable of and in need of sanctification. The songs are, in a word, idolatrous. They make storge a goddess. Those who treat storge like a goddess are her enemies as well as ours. Well, that concludes what I have to say about storge, and now I change my subject and go over to my next theme, philia, or friendship.
Welcome to Session 2. During this lesson, C.S. Lewis continues his intriguing examination into the nature of love by introducing the unique characteristics of friendship. These days, friendship, or philia, as it's called in the Greek, is hardly considered a love at all. C.S. Lewis virtually stands alone among contemporary Christian thinkers in devoting so much of his attention to this topic. He reminds us that historically in human relations, the highest value was placed on this particular love, as in the friendship between David and Jonathan. Lewis followed this biblical example throughout his personal life by investing himself in a core group of figures who later became known as the Inklings. They included the likes of literary scholar and novelist Charles Williams, lawyer and essayist Owen Barfield, artist and avid reader Arthur Greaves, and, as mentioned earlier, author and professor J.R.R. Tolkien, whom Lewis credits as being a crucial factor in his conversion to Christianity. It makes sense that these dear friends were all writers or scholars on some level. You see, Lewis teaches that the ideal climate for friendship exists when a few people are absorbed in some common but not always necessary interest. As usual, Lewis captures the very essence of the nature of friendship with this description. Lovers are usually imagined face to face. Friends are best imagined by side, their eyes ahead on the common interest. Now, as you continue with the four loves, keep in mind this useful proverb. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. God bless you as you move forward with this challenging and moving series.
I want to talk about philia. In our age, it's much harder to talk about this than about storge and eros. When those are your theme, you find a prepared audience. Their importance and beauty and value have been stressed and indeed exaggerated again and again. But very few modern people think friendship a relation of comparable importance. We readily admit that besides a wife and family, a man wants a few friends. But the very tone of the admission, the very meaning it gives to the word friends, make it clear that friendship is very far from being regarded as a main course in life's banquet, or even a course at all. It's more like the bread you crumble almost unconsciously during a long dinner. It's one of the etc. Why this has happened is well worth inquiry. The first and most obvious answer is that most people don't think about it because a great many people don't experience it. It's hard to get through life without encountering some kind and degree of both Eros and Storge. And of course it's impossible that life should go on unless many people felt both, because without Eros none of us would be begotten, and without Storge none of us would be reared. The peculiarity of friendship is that it's not unavoidable. Thousands of people have lived and died without knowing it. To be sure, 900 of each thousand will have had what we commonly call friends, people they drink with and play games with and chat with and cooperate with, perhaps amicably enough in their profession. But this useful and pleasant relationship is not of itself what I mean by friendship. There's lately arisen, too, a much nastier bit of evidence to show that the experience of philia is not universal. I mean, of course, the fact that if you speak of it with any seriousness, you are now quite likely to be suspected of homosexuality. This is extremely revealing. It doesn't at all prove that those who bring the charge are homosexual themselves. Nor would I moralize upon them if they were. How a man can feel anything but bewildered pity for the genuinely homosexual, I've never been able to understand. What it does prove is that they have either never known friendship or never known Eros. For I appeal to everyone who's known both to bear me witness that in some ways nothing is so unlike a friendship as a love affair. Lovers talk incessantly about their love, friends hardly ever about their friendship. Lovers talk incessantly to one another about one another, friends about anything rather than that. The characteristic posture of lovers is face to face, that of friends side by side. Admittedly, friendship between man and woman can turn into love, but the very fact that we can speak of turning into implies the difference. Of course, it's not to be denied that just as philia and normal Eros may be united in the relationship of a man to a woman, so philia and perverse Eros may be blended in a relation between persons of the same sex. In certain cultures, at certain periods, this has been common. In warlike societies, homosexuality is especially likely to creep into the relation between the mature brave and his young armor-bearer or squire. The Greek tradition of high heroic friendship is widely infected with paederasty. But things which can coexist are not, therefore, necessarily the same. They may, in the long run, be antagonistic. What might possibly confuse the issue is the fact that until quite modern times, male friendship normally expressed itself through kisses, embraces, and tears. Such behavior might be connected with a repressed erotic element, but no one with any historical sense could suppose this was always so. Its very prevalence proves the opposite. The erotic diagnosis has implications too comic to be accepted. I can't believe that Johnson embraced Boswell for that reason. The truth is, of course, that what needs explaining, what is anomalous and eccentric, is not the demonstrative gestures of old friendship, but the apparent coldness of ours. The marked repugnance which I, like many moderns, feel for any close physical contact with my own sex may itself be mildly pathological. Now, this modern suspicion of friendship by the amateur psychological wiseacres, the modern indifference to it shown by nearly everyone, the possibility of passing a whole life without experience of it, and the immense prestige which it once enjoyed and has now lost, are not unrelated phenomena. They all spring from one fact, the fact that philia is, in one sense, the least natural of the loves. It has least commerce with our nervous system. There's nothing throaty about it, nothing that quickens the pulse or makes you red or pale. It's not, in its full development, a biological necessity. The individual can live and breed and protect himself without it. Eros and Storge are too obviously connected with the body, too widely shared with the beasts, too closely linked with biological necessity. In them, one could almost feel that nature pulls the strings and we are the puppets. In philia, on the other hand, we have the feeling, whether illusory or not, of being free from all that. Hence, friendship alone of all the loves seemed to our ancestors to raise us to the level of gods or angels. Thus, some men have exalted and others have depreciated or denied the love called philia for exactly the same reason, because in it man seems furthest removed from the animal, from the irrational, and from necessity. This does not seem to me a good ground either for praising it or disparaging it. For, as I said before, nothing in man is either better or worse because he shares it with the beasts. Nor does anything need to be justified by its survival value. The things which make survival worth having are not to be rated below the things which enable us to survive. If everything that's not harnessed to the biological wagon is to be called perversion, then we must say, as I said before, that humanity itself, and the more human the more so, is the greatest perversion of all. In early communities, the cooperation of the males as hunters or fighters was no less necessary than the begetting and rearing of children. Long before history began, we men have got together apart from the women and done things. We had to. We not only had to do the things, we had to talk about them. We had to plan the hunter fight, and when they were over, we had to hold a post-mortem and draw conclusions for future use. We like this even better. In all these pleasures, there was a savour quite different from anything we usually experienced in our relationships with the women. Meanwhile, of course, the women were doing things together apart from us. Being a man, I naturally know less what they were like. But I know, as all men know, in my very bones what the men were doing. As some wag said, the caveman may or may not have had a club on his shoulder, but he quite certainly had a club in the other sense, a place where he sat and talked and talked. It was very probably part of his religion. But all this is not yet friendship. I don't at all want to undervalue the merely clubbable element in our lives. It's necessary. And perhaps of all relationships, camaraderie produces the fewest pains and the most pleasures, often wholly innocent and recreative pleasures. A life without it would be crippled. And for my own part, I have the deepest suspicions of those wretched people who find no pleasure in the society of their own sex. Heaven protect me from the man who needs only women and the woman who needs only men. But at the same time, we must insist that friendship is not simply camaraderie or companionship. Those who don't experience friendship or philia proper think that friend means only comrade or companion, one with whom we can collaborate easily or spend our leisure agreeably. But those who know philia make a distinction. Among their 100 or so comrades, only 5 or 6 may be in the true sense friends. Of course, in ordinary conversation, they apply the word friends to the whole 100, but that is a façon de parler. A polite fiction, like the adjective dear at the beginning of a letter. Those whose society we enjoy may fail in 2 different ways to qualify for the title of friends. First, we may enjoy a man's conversation without liking the man. He may be highly intelligent or amusing. So long as he will talk on a subject we want to learn about, or so long as he makes good jokes, we may be delighted. The moment the conversation moves on to a deeper level and forces us to attend to his personality, we may be repelled. We may even receive from him pleasures we're ashamed of, as when we listen to a scandalmonger. There are, it's true, people who seem never to make this distinction. Liking a man and liking his talk are for them all one. The confusion is elementary. But we needn't be surprised at it when we remember that other people can't distinguish between liking an actor's performance and liking the actor as a man, nor between enjoying a book and imagining that they like the author. But everyone can understand the opposite situation, in which we like the man but find his society rather dull. And so also there are wits whom we enjoy without love, without esteem, and without confidence. Secondly, there may be a man with whom, while we live in the same place or share the same job, while we have the same recreations, we seem to be in the relation of friendship. Then the chances of life separate us. We meet him 5 years later and find that when the first delighted greetings have passed and a few reminiscences have been interchanged, We have hardly a word to say to him, nor he to us. Neither of us need have changed at all seriously in character, yet both have mistaken for a deep union of personalities what was really only a common stock of aims, hardships, hopes, fears, triumphs, annoyances, and jokes, externally provided by the place or job they happen to share. Now, it's just here that the friend is most clearly distinguishable from the companion. After almost any tract of time or any change of residence or occupation, the old unity will be intact. Everything will be taken up again as if we'd been parted only for a few hours. We've no need to fall back on reminiscences, though we may do so for the pleasure of it, but we're not reduced to them, whereas the attempted revival of mere companionship has no other coin. The difference between mere companionship and friendship depends on the nature of the shared activity. The men of the tribe sit talking together because they are all hunters and warriors. Take the individuals apart, place them for a few years in different cultures, using different techniques, facing different problems, and then reassemble them. I very much doubt if the old companionship, the old club, would come to life again. For the bond of union lay in their functions, not in the personalities of each. But if in that prehistoric club there had been two who went sometimes apart to talk of something which the rest had no bent for, two who were groping their way towards the beginnings of art or philosophy or religion, then I should expect that those two, at such a reunion as I'm imagining, would resume their old relationship. They are linked together not as warriors or trappers, but as men, as the very two men they were and are. The activity they shared, they always will share as long as they are the same men. As Montaigne says, a man is my friend because he is he, because I am I. Whereas a man is my comrade because he is my colleague or neighbor or ally. But does not Eros, does not the love between man and woman also say, because she is she, because I am I? Certainly, but Eros doesn't mean quite the same thing. Eros means, because she is my goal, my journey's end, my quarry, because I need her and she me, because we are key and lock, thirst and water, seal and wax. But friendship means, because he has the same goal, because he is taking the same journey, because he is hunting the same quarry, because we are both filled with the same need. I am speaking, of course, of Eros here in a sort of chemical purity from which, thank God, he is usually preserved in ordinary life, where happy Eros is nearly always combined with storge and very often with friendship too. Now, by saying that Eros can be combined with friendship, I have, you noticed, assumed that there can be friendship between a man and a woman. There are people who don't believe this. They think that any apparent instance of it is usually a disguise for Eros or the beginning of Eros. And there are also people who think there are no true friendships between women and women. Both views are, in my opinion, wrong as generalizations, but I am afraid they are likely enough to be true of many societies or classes within societies at certain periods. Companionship is the soil out of which friendships grow, and where the soil is lacking, of course, the plant will not exist. Where men work and women don't, or where they do quite different work, or again where men are educated and women not, or where the sexes have different educations, there will be no companionship, and therefore no friendships between the sexes. They can meet only in Eros and Storge. For I don't think lovers can be in the true sense friends as well as lovers, unless they are the sort of man and the sort of woman who would have been friends even if they had not fallen in love. But quite often, though there was no companionship between the sexes, the women have had their own companionship parallel to and distinct from that of the men. In many primitive communities, they go together to the washing pools or to sow the fields. A whole female life, with its own labours, rituals, sometimes even its own language, is built up, and the men are as jealously excluded from it as the women are from theirs. That is one possible and tolerable state of affairs. Friendships between women and women, friendships between men and men, but none between the sexes. Another possible state of affairs, which I like very much better, is that which we see nowadays in those societies where men and women, rarely equal in education, collaborate in the same professions and have the same tastes. Real friendships can then arise both between women and women, and between women and men, and between men and men. But unfortunately, there are in the modern world quite a number of women who get the benefit of neither system. Such is many a well-to-do married woman in our own professional classes. What work she does, and labour-saving gimmicks have left her little to do, is done alone in her own flat or house. Other women are not her colleagues or comrades. They're merely visitors or neighbours. On the other hand, she may be totally unfitted for any real companionship, hence for any real friendship, either with her husband or with any of his circle. Of course, she has had what is officially, almost ironically, called an education. But if her husband and his friends are, say, doctors, clergymen, lawyers, scholars, or scientists, she is, for all the practical purposes of companionship with them, uneducated. They can't talk to her about the sort of things friends talk about. I don't mean merely the shop of their particular professions, but the whole world of ideas which presupposes a highly educated mind. Of course, affectionate husbands and polite, long-suffering friends will pretend it is otherwise. And, of course, an aggressive woman will insist on being treated as if it were otherwise. But neither expedient helps. She can be taken to the right party. She may be laboriously dragged into the conversation. Her interruptions and misunderstandings may be endured with smiling patience. But she hasn't really got into the circle. The moment she joins it, it ceases to be the circle it was. Her very presence destroys it. She has frustrated the others and is frustrated herself. One cannot be surprised if she comes in the end to hate and fear friendship as the enemy of Eros and Storge, the only love she can ever really have. I'm very sorry for the woman in this position. She has fallen between two stools, has lost the old camaraderie with her own sex, yet not advanced to the stage in which she could be the friend on a different level, either of women or of men. But I not only pity her, I also fear her. A huge, glossy and expensive weekly and monthly literature now exists for just such women. Through that, her fear and hatred of philia may be becoming influential. Friendship is a development from mere companionship or camaraderie. It could indeed be defined as companionship transferred to a deeper level, transferred to those desires, fears, hopes, or delights which make us the precise people we are. Hence, the very first step in friendship is not a movement of liking towards another man. That is the second step. First comes the shared activity. To care about something other than friends, even if it were only a hobby, is the precondition of friendship. If you're going nowhere, you can have no travelling companions. If you've nothing to share, you can share nothing. Friendships always come, if they come at all, unasked, unsought, as Keble said. Friends don't talk much about one another, nor about their friendship. On the eve of a long parting, in danger, in sorrow, they may express the deep love and unshakable loyalty that's between them. The very rarity of such explicitness may even make it especially poignant. But friendship would lose its essential character if they were frequent. The fact that friendship is thus normally unexpressed and merely implicit helps to conceal from some observers the truth that it's a form of love at all. It is manifest far more in its results than in any direct emotional impact, as a man's love of God is better gauged by the tenor of his whole life than by his moments of what the theologians call sensible consolation. This comes out strongly in its reaction to bereavement. We may feel, in one sense, and at the moment, the death of a great friend less than the death of someone or something which we loved with very moderate storge, even an animal. The one may fill our eyes with tears, the other not. But the death of the object loved with storge may, after that momentary and not wholly painful tenderness, make hardly any difference to our lives. The death of the friend may impoverish us every year or every month till we die. We are like a man who has lost a limb. The stump may not ache, or not much, but no more tennis, no more mountain walks. Write it all off. Again, the seriousness and importance of friendship is masked for some people by a characteristic which is really its glory. It is unnecessary. It is arbitrary, a thing of choice. We are no way obliged to make any man a friend, and we have no claim that any man should become ours. It is more nearly disinterested than any other love. Friends may be useful and may increase our happiness, but it's impossible to make them our friends with this in view. In a word, it's free. And with this freedom goes a certain noble irresponsibility. I hope the word won't be misunderstood. Of course, we have responsibilities to every man. Every man is his brother's keeper. And if to leave any man unhelped or uncomforted, when help and comfort are in our power, is bad, so to leave a friend is worse. But such good offices are not the stuff of friendship. They're a byproduct. The mark of perfect friendship is not that help will be given, of course it will, when the pinch comes, but that, having been given, it makes no difference at all. It was an anomaly, a distraction. It had interrupted the conversation. For, of course, friends don't want to know one another's affairs at all. You can become friends with a man before you know whether he's married or single or how he earns his living. In a circle of true friends, each man stands for nothing but what he is. No one cares about anyone else's family or professional status or class or regional origin or nationality or previous history. In fact, all the things biographers want to know, they care nothing about. In time, of course, all these things will be revealed, but not for their own sake. They will come in accidentally. That is the delight of philia, the contact of stripped or disentangled souls. For eros, naked bodies. For friendship, naked personalities. You'll notice that I've passed inevitably from speaking of a pair of friends to speaking of a group. Two is not, in fact, the perfect number for friendship. Hence, though jealousy can creep in here, as where not, friendship is by nature the least jealous of all loves. Two friends will be glad to be joined by a third, and three by a fourth. When two or three or five of us, after a hard day's walking, have come to our inn, when our slippers are on and our feet spread out towards the blaze, and our drinks are at our elbows, and the whole world and something beyond the world opens itself to our minds, and no one has any claim on or any responsibility for any of the others, but all freemen and equals, as if we just met half an hour ago, while nonetheless an affection mellowed by the years is there and fills up the chinks, then we may well wonder whether on the natural level there is anything better than this. And of course, in a sense, nothing is. Nothing is ever better than what's best in its own kind. The greatest wine cannot be better than a slice of perfectly good bread. It's no wonder, then, that past ages thought friendship the crown of life. It is the least jealous, the least demanding of loves, almost free from self-interest, immune from the internal corruptions of storge. It can, as the ancients thought, be a school of virtue. If men are good at all, they become better by mutual friendship. Each lives up to all the rest. We could easily be tempted to regard it, not merely as an analogy to, but a real foretaste of, the heavenly unity. Notice, however, that Scripture has not chosen this sort of love as the symbol of divine love. It has chosen storge, God is our Father, and we his sons. It has chosen eros, Christ is the bridegroom of the church. More than that, the most completely animal and self-regarding of all our appetites has been chosen to become the vehicle of our most strictly commanded communion with God. Eat this, drink this. It looks as if God, or God's plans for our redemption, were not in the common sense of the word half so spiritual as the higher paganism supposed. He seems to descend deepest into nature when he intends to lift us highest. Blood and guts and glands and genes and things of that sort don't repel him. Negative spirituality, departure from the animal and the instinctive, doesn't of itself seem to please him particularly. By its spirituality, friendship escapes some of the obvious dangers of the other loves. Its danger lies precisely in its spirituality. Consider how a circle of friends, such as I've been describing, appears from outside. Almost every name given to it is in some degree unpleasant. It's a set, a coterie, a gang, a mutual admiration society. To belong to a group of real friends is to be armed, in a degree which friendless men can't imagine, against influences from without. The public opinion within the group may be tiny, but it matters more than the opinion of 10,000 outsiders. The approval of those whom we love and honour is the approval we value. Every knot of friends is thus a resistance movement. And, of course, the external pressures which it arms us to resist may be good ones or bad ones. In it we may retreat into something better or worse than the public world. It may be a nursery of martyrs or of criminals. In real life, friendship can unite by what is still good in them, men otherwise very bad, and thus fortify them in evil. There can, for example, be an aristocratic caste, very cruel and unjust to the rest of the world, but quite genuinely united within by friendships, mutual loves, honour and courtesy. The more real and even lofty the friendship within such a caste is, the more it may steel their nerves and stop their ears to all claims from without. The same man who would die for his brother in arms might not deny himself one bottle of wine or one game of cards to save a village of peasants from massacre. The sufferings and the moral judgments of outsiders don't affect him. It's the approval of his friends that matters. Friendship, as we've seen, is based on sharing at depth of activities and attitudes, a relation between souls side by side. The things shared may be good or bad or mixed. Friendship doesn't transform them. It raises them, for good or ill, to a higher power and gives them more confidence. It makes brave men braver, kind men kinder, pious men more pious, cruel men more cruel, proud men more proud. It underlines, endorses, sanctions, defends either from true or from false shame whatever they were doing already. If you and I want to evade some dangerous duty, the best plan is to find two or three other cowards and do our shirking in company. It's wonderful how little discomfort you'll feel when we've talked it all over and laughed it all over together. Equally, if we have to stand out against a real evil, to risk embarrassment and jeers and the possible loss of a job, the best plan is to get together with two or three other honest men. The ordeal will become amazingly less formidable. Friends, in a word, give us moral support or immoral support. I've glanced at extreme examples, but they're extremes of a moral ambivalence which is inherent in friendship. It can be a school of individual humility, but with this individual humility, how easily there comes a corporate pride. I may be unworthy, but we, the set, are magnificent. Loyalty to the spirit of a noble circle, adherence to its standards, has so often proved for us the road to goodness that we may come to mistake it for goodness itself. To stand by our friends, to stick to the firm, to go down with the ship, these things being almost absolutes, may become absolutes. Aucassin, in the story, said he would rather go to hell with the knights and ladies and troubadours than to heaven with the hermits. Now a man must be very good, or, and that's the trouble, very bad, not to feel in himself a response to that gesture. A kind of heroic loyalty is often mixed with that corporate impenitence which binds bad men together in their last stand. Friendship is a resistance movement. It can resist God as well as society. And yet all the time by a kind of goodness, or what had been goodness in it. Friendship is the most spiritual loves, and therefore its corruption the most spiritual corruption. A certain kind of mother may be like a man-eating tigress, a certain kind of lover like a rutting animal. Storge and Eros can fall by animality. But friendship gone wrong liberates not the animal in man, but the titanic or diabolical. It is high-minded. It can have proud looks. By its nature, it must and should defy popular opinion. It may go on to defy mercy and justice and God himself. This love, too, can breed unlove. Nothing, not even friendship, is good except goodness.
I'm pleased to welcome you to Session 3. We're now midway through the Four Loves audio series, and we've heard C.S. Lewis speak eloquently about two manifestations of love, both with their own traps. Storge is jealous and can be a terrifying hunger, while philia, at least in today's society, may be misread as overtures or used to satisfy one's own desires. Now we're about to hear Lewis guide us through the sometimes mystifying, sometimes magical world of Eros, the passionate love between the sexes. It too has its numerous traps, as we see so well today. According to Lewis, this love is different from mere physical desire. In Eros, a person is taken out of him or herself, valuing the beloved above happiness and pleasure. Simply put, one of the first things it does is to obliterate the distinction between giving and receiving. This concept, along with several others that Lewis will introduce, takes current societal views about sex and turns them upside down, or better yet, as Lewis would put it, turns them right side up. So many are so far off the mark in this area. Although Lewis admits that Eros is difficult to explain, he does so masterfully, with frankness and good humor, as you're about to hear.
I want to turn to the very difficult and even dangerous theme, the kind of love I call Eros, by which I don't mean sexual experience in general, but that special variety of it we call being in love. That the state of being in love is a specifically, though not universally human, variation of sexual experience, I don't propose to dispute. We must notice at once, however, that this statement is part of our reconstructed history of the universe, not necessarily a description of what all people feel to be happening when they fall in love. It may be what some feel. A man may, for all I know, sometimes first feel sexual desire for a woman, and then afterwards go on to fall in love with her. I suspect this is rather rare. It's what schoolboys imagine that falling in love will be like. Often, I believe more often, what goes on in consciousness is the reverse. What comes first is a delighted preoccupation with the beloved in her totality. It hasn't, so to speak, leisure to think of sex. She's primarily a person. Even the fact that she's a woman may seem for a while almost irrelevant. It's far more important that she's herself. If you asked a lover what he wanted, and if he knew himself well enough to speak the exact truth, I think he'd reply, "I want to go on thinking about her." He's a contemplative. And when, at a later stage, the explicitly sexual element awakes, he won't feel, unless scientific theories are influencing him, that this had all along been the root of the whole matter. Thus there's a certain opposition between our generalized historical picture and our experience. In the one, sex sprouts or flowers or develops into or elaborates and disguises itself as Eros. In the other, Eros takes over and reorganizes sex like an invader, taking over and reorganizing the institutions of a conquered country. The nature of his reorganization is, I suppose, very generally understood. The only difficulty comes from the fact that wholly untransformed and wholly transformed sexuality don't occur in everyone's experience. There's a whole twilight of intermediate stages. In them, the subject may be deceived about his own condition. Under the influence of sentimental idealism, he may suppose himself nearer to the transformed condition than he really is. Under the influence of a doctrinaire cynicism or realism, he may make the opposite mistake. But the extremes in their, so to speak, chemical purity are not uncommon, and I'll concentrate on them for clarity's sake. Sexual desire without Eros wants it, the thing itself. And the thing, of course, to speak plainly, is a sensation located, like all sensations, within one's own body. There's no more unfortunate idiom than that which makes us say that a lustful man prowling the streets wants a woman. In a sense, that's exactly what he does not want. All he wants her as he wants a packet of cigarettes or a bottle of wine. Wants, that is, the sensations he will have in smoking or drinking. Similarly, he wants a pleasure for which a woman is the necessary piece of apparatus. How much he wants the woman herself may be gauged by his attitude to her 5 minutes after fruition. One doesn't keep the packet after one smoked the cigarettes. Now, Eros does make it possible in the strictest sense to want a woman. Not, of course, any woman, but this one. The lover, in some mysterious fashion, desires the beloved rather than the pleasure she can give. No one ever sought the embraces of the woman he loved as the result of a calculation that she would be more pleasurable than any other woman. Without Eros, this desire, like every other bodily desire, is primarily a fact about ourselves. Within Eros, it's about the beloved. It becomes almost a mode of perception and certainly a mode of expression, something outside us in the real world. Eros, though the father of pleasures, has usually the air at his height of regarding pleasure as a byproduct. Hence, in his realm, the miraculous combination of great desire with great ease in abstaining. And anyway, whose pleasure? The distinction of giving and receiving is here obliterated. Now, this whole talk would go astray if I didn't at once say with every possible emphasis that these distinctions are not intended to carry any moral valuation at all. The sinfulness or innocence of the act of love does not depend in the least on the presence or absence of eros. Right and wrong turn on things far plainer and more prosaic than fine shades of feeling. This act, like any other, is to be justified by its conformity to the great rules, on the keeping or breaking of promises, on justice or injustice, on charity or selfishness. Thousands of generations of our ancestors were married off in early youth to partners chosen by their parents with whom they were not in love. Dozens of them were good people and kept their vows. The mutual duty of paying their marriage debt, as it was called, was discharged with no other ammunition than plain animal appetite, for no other was to be had, and they did right. On the other hand, this act, done under the influence of a soaring and iridescent eros, may yet be plain adultery, may involve breaking a wife's heart, deceiving a husband, betraying a friend, polluting hospitality, and abandoning one's children. Fine feelings don't mend the matter at all. In my distinctions between sexuality in general and eros, I have not been evaluating, but only trying to define. I now turn to questions which do involve good and evil. With mere sexuality, and all the sufferings and sins it has scrawled across human life, I'm not concerned. My subject is eros. But this subject itself forces us to make a distinction between eros in general and the explicitly or carnally sexual element within it. It's been widely held in the past, it's perhaps held by some unsophisticated people today, that the moral danger of eros derives chiefly from the carnal element, and that eros is in some sense best or noblest or purest when this is reduced to a minimum. Hence some of the older moral theologians seem to have thought that the thing chiefly to be guarded against in marriage was a soul-destroying surrender to the senses. Notice, however, that this is not the scriptural approach. St. Paul, dissuading us from marriage, says nothing at all about that side of the matter, except to discourage prolonged abstinence from the act of love. What he fears is preoccupation, the need of constantly pleasing, that is, considering one's partner, the multiple distractions of domesticity. It's marriage itself, not the marriage bed, which will be likely to prevent us from waiting uninterruptedly on God. And surely St. Paul's right. If I may trust my own experience, it is, within marriage as without, the prudential and practical cares of this world, and even the smallest and most prosaic of those cares, which are the great distraction. My prayers have more often been hindered by petty anxieties and decisions about the conduct of the next hour or so than by any passion or appetite whatever. It seems to me clear that the medieval writers, themselves nearly all celibates, were unaware of the change eros works upon sexuality. Preoccupation with the beloved may indeed be an obstacle in the spiritual life, but not, I think, chiefly that kind of preoccupation. Nevertheless, the act of love, within eros, between lovers, is haunted, and especially in our time, by its proper danger. The problem is to regard it with the right kind and the right degree, no more, of seriousness. Of course, considered in relation to its possible consequences and to the marriage vow, it is as serious as any natural action could be. I'm not speaking of that. I'm speaking of it considered, as all lovers do and must consider it, in itself. Now, the act of love, Venus, as our ancestors called it, has even on those terms its own inherent kind of gravity, but it's also very possible to take it too seriously or with the wrong seriousness, and especially today. A preposterous and ludicrous solemnization of sex has been going on almost since my life began. Nothing is more needed on this subject at the moment than a good outbreak of belly laughter. One author tells us that Venus should recur through the married life in a solemn sacramental rhythm. A pupil tells me that a novel, which I had damned as pornography, couldn't really be pornographic because it treated the whole matter so seriously, as if a long face were some kind of disinfectant. The technicians, so to call them, have so bedeviled us with the immense psychological importance of getting this act right and the all but impossibility of doing so, that one imagines some young couples now go to it with the complete works of Freud, Kraft, Ebbing, Dr. Stopes and Havelock Ellis laid out on bed tables all round them. Then there's D.H. Lawrence too, and the whole Pillar of Blood school. We're threatened with something like a revival of the phallic religion. But we must not be totally serious on this subject. Indeed, we can't be totally serious without doing violence to our humanity. It's not for nothing that every language and literature in the world at every period is full of jokes about sex. Many of them may be dull or disgusting. Nearly all of them are past their first youth. They may sometimes be an occasion of sin, though not so often, I believe, as people have thought. But we must insist. They express an attitude to Venus which, in the long run, endangers the Christian life far less than one of reverential seriousness. Love ceases to be a demon only when he ceases to be a god. We must not attempt to find the absolute in the flesh. Banish play and laughter from the bed of love, and you have let in a pagan gravity. The mass of the people are perfectly right when they insist that Venus is a partly comic spirit. Venus herself will take a revenge if we accept her occasional claims to total seriousness. Venus herself, a mocking spirit, far more elf than goddess, makes game of us. Where all external circumstances are fittest for her service, she will leave one or both the lovers totally indisposed. Where every overt act is impossible and even glances cannot be interchanged, in crowded shops and at interminable parties, she will assail both with all her powers. Then an hour later, when time and place agree, she will have mysteriously withdrawn, perhaps from only one. Oh, what a pother this must raise! What self-pities, resentments, suspicions, wounded vanities, and all the current chatter about frustration in those who have treated her like a serious goddess. Sensible lovers laugh, of course. It's all part of the game. A game of catch-as-catch-can, and the escapes and tumbles and head-on collisions are to be treated as a romp. Only if we so treat them shall we fall soft and lose with good temper and win, when we do win, light-heartedly. There are three views of the body. To some, it is a sack of dung, food for worms, a prison, filthy, shameful, never to be thought of except for the purpose of self-humiliation. That, oddly enough, is a common view among ancient pagans. To others, it is glorious. By it, rather than by his soul, man is godlike. Nudists, I suppose, think so. Thirdly, we have the view which St. Francis expressed when he called his body Brother Ass. All three may be, I'm not sure, defensible, but St. Francis for my money. Ass is exquisitely right, because no one in his senses could either reverence or hate a donkey. It's a useful, sturdy, lazy, obstinate, lovable, and infuriating animal, deserving now the stick and now a carrot, at once pathetically and absurdly beautiful. So the body. There's no living with it unless one recognizes that part of its function in our lives is to play the role of buffoon. And, of course, every man, woman, and child in the world does recognize this until some theory has sophisticated them. The fact that we have bodies is the oldest and most universal of all jokes. The error consists in supposing that Eros can or should permanently abolish the joke. That isn't what happens. The conduct and bearing and the very facial expressions of all the sane and happy married couples we know make this quite clear. Lovers, like everyone else, continue to feel an element, not only of play or comedy, but even of buffoonery in the body's expression of Eros. And the body, in this relation as elsewhere, would betray and frustrate us if this ceased to be so. It would be too clumsy an instrument for rendering love's music, unless this very clumsiness could be felt as adding its own grotesque charm. Better plant it foursquare within the drama of Eros as comic relief than pretend it isn't there. But, of course, the poetry is there as well as the unpoetry, the gravity of Venus as well as the levity. But this gravity, which Venus sometimes puts on, is the very reason for preserving also a hint of play in our attitude to her. Natural things are dangerous when they begin to seem too divine. We must understand and distinguish. This is especially true of an attitude which Venus at her gravest calls forth in most, though not all, pairs of lovers. This act may invite the man to an extraordinary though brief dominance as of conqueror or captor, and the woman to a corresponding abjection and surrender. Hence, as in Shakespeare, the lover's pinch which hurts and is desired. How are a sane man and woman to think of this, or a Christian man and woman to permit it? The answer, as I see it, brings out the difference between friendship and Eros at its extreme. In friendship, a man counts for precisely himself, no less, no more. But in the act of love, we are not merely ourselves. We are representatives also. In this kind of love, it's not an impoverishment, it's an enrichment, to be aware that great natural forces work through us. In us, too, all the masculinity and all the femininity in the universe strive to meet. The man does play Sky Father, and the woman does play Earth Mother. He does play Sun and she Earth, he Form and she Matter. But all sanity and Christendom require that we should give full weight to the word play. A woman who accepted as literally her own this extreme self-surrender would be an idolatress, offering to a man what belongs only to God. And a man would have to be a coxcomb, why, a very turkey coxcomb and a blasphemer, if he arrogated to himself as the mere person he is, the sort of sovereignty to which Venus momentarily raises him. Of course, man can't really wear the crown of the Sky Father, only a replica of it done in tinsel paper. I don't call it so in contempt. Paper crowns have their legitimate, and within the proper context, their serious uses. They are, in the long run, not much less absurd, if imagination mend them, than all earthly crowns. Thus considered, the act of love may, if we like, be regarded as a sort of pagan sacrament or natural mystery. But I dare not say this without once digressing to guard against any possible danger of confusing it with an incomparably higher mystery. As nature crowns man in that brief action, so the Christian law crowns him in the permanent relationship of marriage, bestowing, or shall I say imposing, a certain headship on him. But this is a very different crown. As there's a danger of taking the natural mystery too seriously, so there's danger of not taking the Christian mystery seriously enough. Writers like Milton speak of the husband's headship with a levity to make the blood run cold. They'd better reread St. Paul. The husband is the head of the wife just in so far as he is to her what Christ is to the church. He is to love her as Christ loved the church and, read on, and gave himself for her. Isn't it clear that this headship is most fully embodied in that man whose marriage is most like a crucifixion, whose wife receives most and gives least, who is most unworthy and in her own mere nature least lovable? For the church has no beauty except what her bridegroom bestows on her. He doesn't find but must make all her loveliness, and in making her his bride he has infinitely descended. The chrism of this terrifying coronation is to be found not in the joys but in the sorrows of marriage, whether these come by sickness or poverty, by the sufferings and perils of a good wife or the faults of a bad one. It is not the triumphant bridegroom who fully enacts this headship. It is some seedy, careworn elderly husband, inured to unreproachful self-denial, burdened with all duties and denied all rights, finally loving the unlovable and forgiving the unforgivable. Forgiving, not acquiescing in, a King Cophetua who, after a quarter of a century, can still hope that the beggar woman he has married will some day learn to wash behind her ears, as Christ can still see in the soiled and tattered church on earth the bride who will one day be without spot or wrinkle. The sternest feminist needn't grudge to my sex the crown offered it, either in the natural or in the Christian mystery. The one is of paper, and the other is of thorns. From Venus, the carnal ingredient within Eros, I now turn to Eros in general, and here I think we'll see the same pattern repeated with great consistency. I've already noticed that Eros does not in the act of love aim at pleasure, just in the same way Eros in general doesn't aim at happiness. We may think he does, but when he's put to the test, it proves otherwise. Everyone knows it's useless to try to separate lovers by proving that a marriage between them would probably be unhappy, not only because they'll disbelieve you, though of course they probably will, but even if they believed, they would still hold on their course. For it's the very mark of Eros that when he is in us, we had rather share unhappiness with the beloved than be happy on any other terms. Even when the impossibility of happiness in marriage with the beloved becomes ineluctably clear, Eros never hesitates to say, better this than parting, better to be miserable with her than happy without her, better our two hearts should break together than mend and be whole apart. If the passion within you doesn't say this, it's not Eros. And here, far more than in the senses, lies his supreme peril and his supreme glory. For Eros, so speaking, must seem to all of us to speak with the voice of a god. This total commitment, this transcendence of self-regard, sounds like a message from the eternal and celestial. And some mistake it, and all who love are tempted to mistake it, for the voice of God himself. But it can't be, for it may urge to evil as well as to good. Nothing shallower than to assume that the love which leads to sin is always somehow qualitatively lower, more animal, or more trivial than what leads to a fruitful and faithful Christian marriage. It may be neither wandering lust nor idle sentiment that draws miserable couples into cruel and treacherous unions and into suicide and murder. It may be Eros himself, heart-rendingly sincere and profound. And whatever he commands us, his voice will still have that divine resonance. And there have been schools of thought which attempted to sanction it and to make out reasons why we should always obey the voice of Eros. The one most likely to be believed in our own day is what may be called Shavian. Shaw himself would have called it metabiological romanticism. According to this view, the voice of Eros is the voice of the élan vital, or life force, the evolutionary appetite. In overwhelming a particular couple, it is seeking parents for the Superman. And it's rightly, on Shaw's view, indifferent both to their personal happiness and to the rules of morality, because something far more important than either, he thinks, the future of our species is at stake. If so, the life force doesn't seem to understand its business very well. Because, of course, the existence or intensity of the Eros between two people doesn't, as far as we can see, furnish any ground for expecting that their offspring will be specially satisfactory, or even that they will have any offspring at all. Two good strains, not two fine lovers, is the recipe for good children. And what was the life force about during the countless generations in which marriage didn't depend on love? Has this bright idea, if it is a bright one, for the improvement of our species only just occurred to it? And anyway, most of the pictures that have been painted of the Superman are so very unattractive that if you believed this theory, you'd be inclined to turn monk in order to avoid the mere risk of begetting him. Neither this theory nor any other kind of erotic transcendentalism can be accepted by a Christian. Even if Eros were the voice of the life force, a Christian could only say, so what? The life force is only a creature and perhaps a fallen one. It would not justify us in obeying Eros unconditionally. But unconditional obedience is just what he seems to demand, divinely indifferent to our self-regard, titanically rebellious to any law of God or man that opposes him. When I wrote long ago about the medieval poets and the strange religion of love which they built up alongside Christianity, I'm afraid I treated this too much as a literary matter. I hadn't noticed how Eros himself, by his very nature, invites this kind of quasi-religious treatment. Of course, moralists have often told us that being in love contained a danger of idolatry. But I think they usually meant that the lovers might idolize one another. I don't myself think that's often the real danger. Lovers, no doubt, may put one another before God, as in every sin we put some finite good before God. And in that sense, we may be said, by a very legitimate metaphor, to commit idolatry whenever we sin at all. The real danger is less that they should make idols of one another than that they should make an idol of Eros himself. I don't mean, of course, that they will build altars or say prayers to him. The idolatry I'm speaking of meets one in the popular misinterpretation of our Lord's words, "Much is forgiven to her because she loved much." In their context, taken with the parable of the two debtors which comes just before, this clearly means that the greatness of her love, agape, for Christ, shows how much has been forgiven to her. But thousands of people take it to mean her sins are forgiven, are forgivable, hardly need forgiveness, because a great passion was their motive. It's almost felt that if this were so, they were not really sins. In love's law, we lovers have our own law or religion, separate from God's law. Where a true Eros, not mere appetite, is present, resistance to any of his commands is felt like apostasy. Temptations speak with the voice of duties, quasi-religious duties, acts of pious zeal. For he builds up his own religion round the lovers. Now they feel they are under his new law, under what in this religion corresponds to grace. They feel they are new creatures. His mere spirit supersedes all laws. These temptations, disguised as a sort of zeal or a sort of piety, needn't, of course, be temptations to unchastity. They are quite as likely to be temptations to act unfairly or uncharitably towards the outer world. It is for love of you that I have neglected my father, for love of you that I cheated my partner. And all the time we have the tormenting paradox that this quasi-god, this Eros whose voice sounds like the eternal, isn't eternal at all. He's notoriously the most desperately mortal of our passions. The whole world rings with complaints of his fickleness. What is puzzling here is not just the fickleness itself. What's really baffling is the combination of this fickleness with his violent assertions that he will be permanent. To be in love is both to intend and to promise eternal constancy. Love makes vows without being asked. I will be ever true are the first words he utters. Now, appetites don't speak with that voice. The man who is moved to overeat or overdrink doesn't at all necessarily resolve on lifelong gluttony or drunkenness. If anything, he's far more likely to assure himself that this is the very last time he will indulge in either. He reaches out his hand for the decanter in order to fortify with one more glass his resolution to become a teetotaler. Far more like the love situation is that of the amorist, no mere sensualist, still less a cynic, who has a new so-called wife or mistress, or at least a new affair, every time we meet him, and is quite certain that this time it's the real thing. His wanderings are over, he's found his true love at last, and to her he will be true to death. The closest parallel to the behaviour of Eros is to be found not in our ordinary appetites, but in what may, perhaps, for convenience, be called the intellectual passion. Beside the amorist sat the faddist. You know, every time you meet him, he has at last found the key to the riddle of the universe. It has been Marx, Freud, Jung, Theosophy, Yoga, and Dianetics. Christianity is often given its turn. And each time, he feels the same certainty. The resemblance is not accidental, and it doesn't, as we might hastily suppose, redound wholly to the discredit of Eros. The passion of the faddist is in a very disordered condition, but it is not a contemptible passion. A brutal and sordid man wouldn't keep on thinking he had found a coherent system of truth. If it were offered him on a plate, he wouldn't care tuppence about it. He'd rather have a drink or a draw on a sweepstake or a new car. The thirst for truth, which the faddist keeps on thinking he has finally slaked, is something men ought to have. He is neither culpable for feeling nor deceived in thinking it of immense value. So with the amorist. But both trust the passion itself, and a very early phase of it, to do for them what no passion can do. A passion can only move us, only supply incentive and energy. It is merely the dive that gets us into the water. Once in, swimming, not diving, is the thing. The faddist's delight in the discovery of, as he thinks, truth, is to be admired, not mocked. The trouble is that he expects the possession and use of truth to be exactly like the discovery. If, after his dive, he used his muscles and swam, his history would be quite different. The amorist similarly expects being in love to be exactly like falling in love. When the delicious falling is over, when the dive's got him into the water, he doesn't know how to go on. He has enjoyed the incentive of the passion. He never discovers what it is an incentive to, so he presently climbs out and tries a dive in a different pond. For love by itself will not keep us in love, or not for very long. Falling in love is something that happens to us. Being in love, still more remaining permanently in love, is something we do. No passion is self-preservative. The promise of permanence which Eros makes can be kept, but it isn't Eros of himself who can keep it. Yet the transcendental quality in his voice, our feeling when in love that this condition should and must be everlasting, is not wholly a deception. What it really signifies is the immense value, and in its possible developments, the really otherworldly and spiritual value of the change which falling in love works upon us. In a moment, it has made appetite itself altruistic, tossed personal happiness aside as a triviality, and planted the interests of another in the centre of our own being. At one bound, it has overleaped the high wall of our selfhood. We find ourselves, as regards one other person, really fulfilling the law, really loving another as ourselves. But having done this, the mere feeling will do no more. Eros has now done his stuff. He will not extend this selflessness to others besides the beloved. He may do quite the opposite. He will not even perpetuate it towards her. He will not of himself, even in that relationship, remain the sort of love he promised to be. He may not remain any sort of love at all. He may simply die. For, of course, as we all really know, mere spontaneous feeling will not keep any pair in love, even for a few months or weeks. The passion in its total and selfless commitment is intermittent, recurrent. The old self soon turns out not to be so dead as it seemed, as often after a religious conversion. In both, the old self may for the moment be knocked flat, but he will soon be up again, if not on his feet, at least on his elbow, if not roaring, at least back to his old surly grumbling or mendicant whine. The corruptions return. Venus will sometimes slip back into mere sexuality. What's 10 times worse, that desire for the beloved herself, for total unity, may take on a morbid form. It may come to be a sort of imperialism, a desire for absorbing without being absorbed, possessing without being possessed, making the beloved, every thought, wish, and interest, a mere reflection of oneself. And since the beloved may often have exactly the same program for you, success, which would be infamous if achieved, is not very probable. At this stage, the couple are almost fortunate if they fall out of love altogether, but they may remain in it, in that sort of love which is increasingly a sort of hatred. One thinks of Anna Karenina and Vronsky in the novel, jealous, exacting, and resentful. The old amorous exaggeration, I could eat you, now takes on a new and horrible meaning. My point isn't that these dangers can't be averted. They are averted daily by thousands of couples, but they're not averted by Eros himself. The lovers who idolized him, who trusted all to the strength of their original emotion, will fare the worst. If love is to remain, and to remain himself, he must be supported by outside help. And this everyone knows. Ah, you need a bit of common sense, they say, or some give and take, or a sense of humour. Yes, but in clearer language, you need a firm will to justice. You need a will already pretty well trained and disciplined. In the long run, you need the grace of God. And in this, Eros is like all the natural loves. They have not within themselves resources to secure their own permanence, or to keep themselves from internal corruptions, nor to be innocent in dealing with those outside the circle of love. To say that they all need correction by higher powers in us and by a power higher than we, though true, is not perhaps the best way of putting it. This suggests that it is always, as it is sometimes, our duty to renounce or diminish them. I should rather say they need the help of higher powers in order to become and remain themselves. The more we trust them to be self-sufficing, self-corrective, and self-perpetuating, the more deceived we shall be. It's rather like a garden. A garden is a glorious thing full of life and giving us life. But you must not trust your garden to weed itself or fence itself or prune itself or anything of that sort. It hasn't got that kind of goodness. A garden left to nature will soon not be a garden. It's the same with our passions. They also are life-giving. But when God planted that garden of our passions, he set a man over it to dress it and set the man under himself.
At the start, this series was introduced to you as an exploration, and C.S. Lewis has indeed taken us on a very valuable and adventurous journey. In Session 4, he assumes the daunting task of explaining the meaning of charity, or divine love. This fourth and final love, agape in Greek, transcends all earthly loves in being a gift love. As human beings, we by necessity have to turn to God for fulfillment and meaning. Look closely, and you will see the pattern repeated all through creation, in our dependence on other people as well as nature. The danger, or trap, if you will, is in fact that our human loves are potential rivals to the love of God. Lewis emphasizes that they can only take their proper place if our first allegiance is to God. To pledge that allegiance should not be a difficult choice when one hears the definition of agape presented in these words from Lewis. God, who needs nothing, loves into existence creatures in order that he may love and perfect them. He creates the universe, already seeing the buzzing cloud of flies above the cross, the flayed back pressed against the uneven stake, the nails driven through the mesial nerves, the repeated incipient suffocation as the body droops, the repeated torture of backs and arms as it is time after time, for breath's sake, hitched up. Herein is love. This is the diagram of love himself, the inventor of all loves. Once again, here's C.S. Lewis.
All through these talks, I've been touching very lightly on a theme which anyone who was treating the natural loves from a Christian point of view would have emphasized far more strongly a few centuries ago. If the Victorians needed the reminder that natural love is not enough, the old theologians were always saying very loudly and sternly that natural love is likely to be a great deal too much. The danger of loving our fellow creatures too little was less present to their minds than that of loving them idolatrously. In every wife, mother, child, and friend, they saw a possible rival to God. And so, of course, does our Lord. There was therefore no question in my mind of simple dissent from the older doctrine. There has been a difference of method. I have taken a roundabout way. In my critique of the loves, I have stressed their rivalry to God less than their failure without God to be completely or to remain securely the sorts of love they profess to be. And this, I hoped, might make it easier for us to believe, and not merely to acknowledge verbally, that they are, after all, second things. Because to let us down while legitimately attracting us is the very characteristic of a second thing which has been treated as a first thing. There is a quite different and highly respected way of trying to divert us from inordinate love of the creature, which I find myself compelled to reject, though I do so with trembling. In words that can still bring tears to a man's eyes, St. Augustine describes the desolation in which he was plunged by the death of his great friend Nebridius. He then goes on to draw what he thinks the moral. This is what comes, he says, of giving your heart to anything but God. All creatures are temporary. It's the very nature of the universe that all individuals should pass away and make room for others. You can't have a temporal universe on any other terms, just as you can't have a spoken sentence, unless each word, after filling the air for a moment, passes away and gives place to the next. To give one's heart to a created being is therefore to court disaster. If love is to mean in the long run happiness, not misery, it must be love for the only beloved that does not pass away. Now, of course, this is obvious and excellent sense. Don't put your goods in a leaky vessel. Don't spend much on a temporary building. There's perhaps no man in the world to whom such canny maxims make a stronger appeal than they do to me. As a boy, though I like chocolate better, I always bought toffee. It lasted longer. I'm almost incurably cautious. No gambler, a safety first man. Gilt-edged securities for me, however low the rate of interest. Of all arguments against excessive love for a fellow creature, none makes so strong a natural appeal to me as, be careful, this may mean suffering. But when I respond to this natural appeal, I feel myself to be 1,000 miles away from the spirit of Christianity. If I'm certain of anything, I'm sure that Christ did not teach in order to confirm my congenital preference for safe investments. And who could conceivably begin to love God on the ground that he is a safer investment, offers better security? Who could even include it among his grounds for loving? One has to be outside the world of love, of all loves, before one thus calculates. Such a view doesn't raise us above the natural affections, it sinks us below them. Eros himself, lawless and rebellious, when he prefers the beloved to happiness, is nearer love itself than this. For our master is one who shed tears at the grave of Lazarus, who mourned over the approaching ruin of his earthly country, and, loving all, yet had one disciple whom in a special sense he loved. And even if it were true that precautions against heartbreak were our highest practical wisdom, even if it were possible for that reason to choose the love of God, would this choice be a precaution? That God offers us security, not gilt-edged but solid gold, I well believe, but not security from sorrow. His love too may break the heart. A broken and a contrite heart awaits most surely those who follow that road most faithfully. For Christ himself that road leads to, "Why hast thou forsaken me?" There is, in fact, no escape into security along the line St. Augustine suggests or along any other. To love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly be broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give it to no one and nothing, not even an animal. You must carefully wrap it round with hobbies and little luxuries and routine and avoidances of entanglement, and then lock it up in the casket or coffin of your own selfishness. And this means that in the long run, the alternative to tragedy, or at least to the threat of tragedy, is damnation. For in that casket, safe, still, and unventilated in the darkness, it will go bad. Not broken, but finally unbreakable, impenetrable, resistant to all good and joy. It's like hiding the talent in the napkin, and for much the same reason, I knew thee that thou wert a hard man. Christ did not teach and suffer, in order that we should become more cautious of our own happiness, even in our natural loves. If a man is not uncalculating and that way reckless in loving his earthly beloveds whom he has seen, how will he be so in his love for God whom he has not seen? We shall draw nearer to the love of God, not by attempting to avoid the sufferings inherent in any love, but by accepting them and offering them to him, by throwing away all defensive armor, taking all risks, descending, when he so wills, into all tribulations. As so often, the words of our Lord himself are at once far fiercer and far more tolerable than those of the doctors. He says nothing about guarding ourselves from earthly loves for fear they should bring us suffering. He says something that cracks like a whip about trampling them ruthlessly underfoot when they hold us back from following him. If any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and his own life also, he can't be my disciple. The crack of the whip is there, I think, because the strength and up to a point legitimacy of the affections is taken for granted. One doesn't bring a battery to demolish a molehill. But what, for practical purposes, does the word hate here mean? That the Lord of love should be telling us to hate, in plain prose, anyone, to cherish feelings of vindictive resentment, to gloat over another's misery and rage at his happiness, is, of course, out of the question. To hate in Scripture means primarily to set aside, discount, reject, almost to fail as an examiner fails a candidate. The duty of, on occasion, hating those whom we love remains, even when thus interpreted, a very terrible one. And it's also very hard to be sure when the occasion has arisen. Some of us are too ready to think that it has, others are not ready enough, and all of us are likely to be mistaken as to which sort of people we are. Sometimes a wise friend knows, more rarely he will tell us, most rarely of all we may endure to be told, what we are. The extent to which a man can discern and then perform this duty will depend on the extent to which his whole life has already been transformed by the Spirit of God. If it has, then the natural love will already have been placed under and in some degree converted into agape. The Cavalier poet could reasonably say, "I could not love thee, dear, so much, loved I not honour more," because his mistress was a cavalier lady who already admitted the claims of honour. There are women, and in other ways not bad ones, to whom the mention of it would be meaningless, just one of those silly things that men talk about. If natural love could in the cavalier lady be thus submitted to such a quarter god, for he's not even a demigod, as honour, how much more should it in a Christian be submitted to agape, that is, to love itself? That brings us back to our main subject. In particular instances, we may have to renounce a natural love altogether. But mercifully, the duty laid upon us is more often that of retaining it and subjecting it to, indeed transforming it into, agape. These natural loves must accept the transformation even for their own sakes, must submit to become second things if they're to remain things at all. For when God rules in a human heart, though he may often have to dismiss some of the native authorities, he often continues some in office, and by subjecting their officers to him, gives them for the first time a firm and durable basis. I know we've been told that when half gods go, the gods arrive, but that seems to me a very doubtful maxim. A heart empty, swept, and garnished of its half gods may expect, as we have been told, an inrush of visitants anything but divine, and I think we've seen it happen in our own generation. I would rather say, when God arrives, and then only, the half-gods can remain. What then is agape, or love itself? We know. God is love. And again, not that we loved God, but that he loved us. We must not begin with mysticism, the soul's desire for God, and the wonderful foretastes of our enjoyment of God, which have been vouchsafed to some even in this life. The best mystics will warn us not to. We must begin with God's love for the creatures. Love itself, God's love, is utterly dissociated from need. It is manifested first in creation and then in redemption. The doctrine that God was under no necessity to create is not a bit of useless and abstract scholasticism. It is essential, for it reveals the nature of agape. That which in itself is complete, self-sufficient, eternally blessed, which has no wants to satisfy, creates what it doesn't need. Creates because, being love, it desires to give, and gives, seeing in the very moment of creation the necessity for the crucifixion. Insofar as we become capable of that sort of love, agape is entering our lives. That element in our natural loves, which consists of our need for the beloved, is not love itself. The desire to be loved is not love itself. The delight in being loved is not love itself. But don't misunderstand. This element is not a sin or impurity in our love, which we must try to expel. The need for the beloved is no more a sin than the need for one's breakfast. To be loved is the soul's food, as bread and meat and vegetables are the body's. A loss of appetite for either would show something wrong. Both are innocent, but both are merely natural. One is not yet in love itself for desiring to be loved and delighting in it. Just in so far as something beyond and other than this need and delight enter our natural loves, so far has agape entered them. And of course, all our natural loves have in them at the outset something the very reverse of agape. In maternal affection, you may say this is not quite so obvious. It is, in one sense, concerned with giving, not getting. But then this giving itself is need. We all know what the cows say when the milkers are late. And I think all the givings, all the cares and toils which proceed from storge have this character. Storge, like charity, is humble and suffers long. Friend, in relation to friend, seeks not his own. Eros counts all things as dung to win the beloved. None of these loves desires the object's good simply for the object's sake. Yet each in its own way imitates love itself. Each makes us, at some moments and to some fellow creatures, what we must come to be at all times and in all relations. They can tune the instrument for that music, but they are not it. As preliminary disciplines for agape, they are demigods. As substitutes for it, they are idols or a kind of mirage. The invitation to turn all natural loves into agape is never lacking. And this, to a Christian, explains why disappointments and frictions must and should await us in them all. Foolish people interpret these in their own way. If only I'd been more fortunate in my children. If only I'd married a different man or woman. If only my friends were more considerate. But from the Christian point of view, these rubs are reminders that the worldly love requires conversion into agape. I don't mean that all those who are not consciously attempting the Christian life take the fool's way. Thousands of unbelievers, or merely nominal believers, get over the rubs and jog along on the whole fairly well, summoning common sense and humour and habit and compromise to their aid when mere feeling is not enough. This is better than nothing, very much better than a life controlled by mere feeling. But what is better is not therefore best. This common-sensible give-and-take adaptability, which keeps so many families together, is not yet love itself, the gift of God. For agape, God's love to the created is doubly a gift. He gives us his love, and with it the gift of loving. By receiving and responding to agape from him, we become able to exercise agape towards others. As a man feeleth God in himself, so is he towards his neighbour, said Tyndale. God, who has loved us into existence, loves us into the power of loving our brethren. What is not perhaps so generally noticed, he also loves us into the power of receiving agape, both from himself and from others. For here we meet a quite unexpected obstacle. On the natural level, we are full of the hunger to be loved, the hunger to receive family affection, erotic love, and friendship. And it might be expected that we had similarly a hunger to receive agape, but this is untrue. There's that in the heart of every man which resists and resents agape from his fellow creatures, or even from his Creator. We naturally want to be desired, to be found delightful, to satisfy worthily some hunger in others. To receive a love which is purely a gift, which bears witness solely to the lovingness of the giver, and not at all to our loveliness, is a severe mortification. We desperately need to receive such love from God and even from our fellow creatures, but we don't naturally want to. Our necessities and our wishes are in conflict. All those expressions of unworthiness which Christianity puts into the believer's mouth seem to the outer world like the self-depreciation of a well-bred Chinaman when he calls himself this contemptible person. In reality, of course, they are expressions of the continually renewed and continually necessary attempt to negate that false conception of ourselves and our relation to God, which nature is always impressing on us. No sooner do we believe that God loves us, than there's an impulse to believe that he does so, not because of what he is, but because of what we are, because we are intrinsically lovable. It's so easy to admit, but so hard really to believe, that we are mirrors whose brightness is wholly derived from the sun that shines on them. Surely we think we must have a little inherent luminosity of our own. As we are to God, so more obviously we are to our fellows. I don't want any of your darned Christian charity, is a very familiar sentence. Of course, it often springs from an ignorance of what Christian charity is, more often from a well-grounded suspicion that Christian charity is not what we're really being offered. Because, of course, much of what is called charity contains so much vanity, self-applause, and veiled contempt that it cannot but be resented. It is hard to bear agape from our fellows, and yet each of us needs it. There is that in each of us which simply can't be loved with natural love. Nobody can be expected to. Only the lovable can be naturally loved. You can't ask men to like the taste of rancid meat. It can be forgiven and pitied and loved with agape, not otherwise. Every listener who has had a good parent or wife or husband or child may be sure that at times he is the recipient of agape, loved not because he is lovable, but because love itself is in the other party. This we must learn, first to believe, then to endure, and then to delight in, and without guessing about it either. Such, I conceive, is the world of agape, a world of unbounded giving and unshamed receiving, where all blessed creatures need and know that they need nothing but God, and are therefore set free to love one another disinterestedly. And so your love shall be like his, born neither of your need nor of my deserving, but a plain bounty. I think those are drawing near to heaven who in this life find that they need men less and love men more, and delight more in being loved without being needed. For where agape is, there in some degree is heaven. In these talks I've spoken most about the power of agape to transform and preserve our natural loves. But I hope I'm leaving no one under the impression that that is agape's function, that she is the means, and the well-being of the natural loves is the end. Of course, it's the other way round. Their ultimate value lies in their power to prepare us for agape, and to provide, as it were, embodiments of agape when God gives it, natural altars on which the flame of agape can descend. It may descend elsewhere. Some will first know it in their relation with enemies, beggars, or criminals, before they learn it in their private and natural loves. It may descend on some altars and destroy them. Sometimes agape to a desperately bad parent or spouse can arise only on the ashes and total renunciation of the natural love. Sometimes bereavement may be necessary. Nearly always there will be frets and rubs. Yet, somehow or other, this conversion of our natural loves into agape is necessary if those natural loves are to enter the heavenly life. That they can so enter, I hope and believe. The resurrection of the body, we may hope, includes the resurrection of what may be called our larger body, the whole fabric of our natural life, with all its affections and relationships. But nothing will rise which hasn't in some degree shared the crucifixion. The fashion of this world passes away. Natural loves can become eternal only in so far as they have allowed themselves to be taken into the eternity of agape. And this always involves a sort of death. That element in my love for wife or child or friend, which it has in common with the love that great saints have felt for lepers and convicts and persecutors, is the eternal element in it. By that element, if at all, the rest of it can hope to be raised again. For it only is love himself, it only is holy, it only is the Lord. But all this time I have taken the love of God to mean solely God's love for men. St. John led me into it. I still think it's the safe and sober approach. But is there no more than this? Isn't the first commandment to love God? Yes. An old book raising the question, is it easy to love God, replies, it is easy to those who do it. As easy, that is, as for the healthy to be healthy, the happy to be happy, or the young to be young. There is indeed a way of loving God, which is easy to none, but possible to all, and we've been told it too. Inasmuch as ye did it to the least of these, my brethren, ye did it to me. We can see the face of Christ in every man and act accordingly. And there is also the love expressed solely in obedience. There is love for the humanity of our Lord, for the holy child or the sufferer. There is also the unsatisfied love thirst or longing for God. But of what is beyond all these, what is neither love of God in man, nor love in obedience, nor love of the man in God, nor love longing, of fruition in this life and foretaste of beatitude, I'm not the man to speak. Even if I had heard rumours or made guesses, I couldn't put them in this form. I need myths and symbols. All that can be said here is that even on those high levels, though something goes from man to God, yet all, including this something, comes from God to man. If he rises, he does so lifted on a wave of the incoming tide of God's love for him. He becomes nothing in that ascension. His love is perfected by becoming, in a sense, nothing. He is less than a mote in that sunbeam, vanishes, not from God's sight, but from ours and his own, into the nuptial solitude of the love that loves love, and in love all things.
You've been listening to an original recording of C.S. Lewis presenting the material from his book, The Four Loves, recorded in 1958, with introduction and commentary by Charles Colson, copyright 2004. This recording may not be reproduced in any way without written permission from the publisher, W Audio, Nashville, Tennessee.